again, with just more requirements of transparency right up front. So we see the contracts, we see what's going into the more requirements that when they test this technology, we get access, or certainly at least Congress gets access to the results of their tests, their internal tests, so we know if it's working. I think we need to beef up the staff on Capitol Hill so that, these 85-year-old members of Congress who don't know what Facebook is, at least have the staff who are technologists who can understand what artificial intelligence is and what goes into making these AI decisions. So I think, we can call out hypocrites or not, but I think what we really need to do is focus on solutions. And I think that those solutions are there and they're possible. And I think that's where we really need to, we need to focus. Now, that said, I will say that the employees of these companies actually have a really strong voice. And we've seen it with Google, we've seen it with others. When the employees object to their employer's technology being sold or being used in a way that they think is violative of people's civil rights or where the company believes in, they have a really strong and powerful voice, and they can change the decision of a company. So that's, I think, something that, employees should understand. They're very, very powerful, and they should take advantage of that as well.
Well, Lisa, give out the website for your organization where people can get the report directly.
Sure, it's openthegovernment.org.
And we link to that from our site. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been Lisa Rosenberg, Executive Director of Open the Government, which just published the report that we've been discussing, Government Inc., Amazon Government Security and Secrecy. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe for our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kolhatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band, Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, The Struggle with Alyssa.
Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Feria Day Portland. On Saturday, May 11th, from 5 to 10 p.m. at the Portland Institute for Contemporary Arts in Portland. The fourth annual Feria Day Portland celebrates the Northwest flamenco community and the culture of Andalusia. The event features local Spanish food vendors, flamenco performances, a full bar, guitar and dance open mics, demonstrations, lectures, and more. Again, that's Feria de Portland on Saturday, May 11th from 5 to 10 p.m. at the Portland Institute for Contemporary Arts, 15 Northeast Hancock Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 9th Annual Keaton Otis Memorial on Sunday, May 12th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Maranatha Church in Portland. Keaton Otis was killed by Portland police May 12th, 2010, Every month since his murder, a vigil has been held at the spot he died. The event will include artists, community members, and leaders. Refreshments and information about the monthly vigils held at Northeast 6th and Halsey, where Keaton was killed. Again, that's the 9th Annual Keaton Otis Memorial on Sunday, May 12th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Maranatha Church, 4222 Northeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Yes, Keaton Otis, we remember you. He is one of the many people who have been killed by Portland police. We remember him. So once more, that's Sunday, May 12th at Maranatha Church. This is the annual memorial for Keaton Otis. We lift you up. This is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator. And this week on The Struggle, I have some messages for you before we jump into our very, very special guests that are here with me today. And I'm going to keep you in suspense. But first, some news from the Little Big Union. Little Big Burger is a place that we all love. And they are retaliating against their workers for protected activity, mm-hmm. who are building their union, and they're calling on community to call up Little Big Burger, if you're a customer or not, and let them know that you want them to respect the workers organizing. The city council budget hearing was at the Forestry Center by the Oregon Zoo yesterday. And the two major messages that were coming from the crowd were to fund parks, particularly to fund the positions of all of the staff that just organized and are finally receiving living wages, family wages, and that the answer to having staff that is paid well is to actually cut the staff, which is what is on the line. And on the other end of that, directly on the other end of that, is the inflated police budget that's being put forward for an even larger amount of money, despite some, let's say, sordid results of the Portland police. So watch this space. The LGBT Queer Union Summit is going to be happening on June 21st. It's going to be at SEIU 49. This is presented by Diamond Law. And they're calling on queer and trans unionists from all over Oregon to come together to discuss strategy for how to devise and successfully execute diversity, equity, and inclusion through a queer and trans lens at the workplace, together in union against the bosses, of course. There's also a Medicare for All Speak Out that's happening Saturday, May 11th at 10 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. That's going to be at Benson High School Auditorium. Pramila Jayapal, the person who introduced the Medicare for All bill into the U.S. Congress, is going to be presenting it. That's on the House side. Of course, Bernie Sanders is introducing it on the Senate side. Then there's also Help Save LERC, which is the Labor Education and Research Center at U of O. It is being proposed that the program be cut, and Phil Knight is the one who's at the wheel. So you put that together. That's the CEO or the founder of Nike. So these are some of the updates that I've been asked to share with you. But finally, what we've all been waiting for. We had 20,000 people in the streets of Portland Wednesday supporting educators and students for full funding from the state. It was a walkout, and I have two of the educators who were in the struggle, who I was happy to be there with, who are here with me now. I have Sean and Justin.
Hello. Hello.
So just some background so that I'm introducing them correctly. Sean's pronouns are he, him. He's a special education teacher for PPS, an activist and union member. Justin is a language arts and special ed teacher and a social and racial justice advocate. And he works for an alternative school, we got to get pronouns right. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. Work for an alternative school in PPS. So I just want to catch people up because you have the pleasure of listening to three trans people today. So aren't you so lucky? Yeah. So we're all going to be talking about education justice. My pronouns are she, her, hers. Again, Sean's are he, him, his. Justin is they, them, theirs. These are just ways that people get to tell you how they would like for you to talk about them. And it's as simple as that. Now, do my lovely guests want to expound on that before we jump into this 20,000 protest that we had on Wednesday?
Incredible. You want to expand on the pronouns?
Yeah, just okay. So that people can know a little bit more, you know, give the elevator pitch.
So context here, I'm a white appearing male, and with that comes a lot of privilege. And I decided about 2 months ago to change my pronouns from he, him to they, them. Because once you tell somebody that your pronouns are they, them, they automatically have questions, and I out myself and have a conversation. So it was intentional for me to change my pronouns so that I can have that conversation with people.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's an exhausting conversation.
It is.
So thank you for doing that work.
Of course.
Because, of course, it's not hard enough as an educator in public school. No. Oh, my goodness. Okay, so this is why we were all out. So public school is getting the hack job all over the place in this country. It is under attack. And it is the educators that are fighting back for their students and asserting that every child deserves a quality education. And it doesn't matter what you say. They deserve it. And we're going to fight for it.
Absolutely.
So this week we got to show in force what it looks like when Portland, Oregon does it. And we really did it right. 20,000 people in the street that were calling on the state to fully fund public schools. Please talk more about the history of this struggle.
Absolutely. So Justin and I are both special education teachers. So we're sort of a microcosm within the public school system. And the public school system in this state has been underfunded for 30 years. Hear that, folks? 30 years it's been underfunded. So when Portland Public Schools announced their decision to preemptively close 81 school buildings on Wednesday, that was a pretty big deal. An unplanned day off from school is a big deal for Portland's 49,000 students, not just for those students, but also for their families and their communities. But teachers see this as a long-term investment in students' future. So that's why we were standing out there. We are continually hearing from our community, from parents, from families, PTAs, advocates, schools, businesses, that our schools are being devastatingly underfunded. Mm-hmm. And students are suffering because of it. And especially that intersectionality piece, disproportionately, students with disability, students of color, students in deep poverty are suffering because of it the most. You want to speak to that a little bit?
So I worked where Sean works for the last 2 years, and then this year I moved on to an alternative school, and mm-hmm. So the focus at that school is mental health. So my focus right now is advocating for students who are experiencing depression, anxiety, PTSD, all kinds of abuse, and the support that they need in schools, which is more counselors. And I had a student tell me yesterday that at her school she had set up to see her counselor whenever she was feeling overwhelmed or anxious or depressed. And she would go see her counselor, and one day her counselor said, "No, you can't come anymore. I have 400 students on my caseload. I don't have time for you every day. We need more support for students with mental health issues in middle schools and high schools." That's what I'm passionate about right now.
Whoa.
And a lot of those kids are LGBTQ.
So I wonder, how did we get here? How is it that this is an acceptable precedence, right? So it's been underfunded for 30 years?
Yep. In 1990, Measure 5 passed, which was a cap on property tax going to schools. And ever since then, the disinvestment has continued and continued and continued. It's continued under Democratic leadership. It has continued. So now what we've got is we've got a governor who is a Democrat and very much on board with increasing school funding, and we have a supermajority in our state Congress.
Can you say what a supermajority is?
A supermajority. That means that no matter how much the other side may kick and scream, they still cannot outvote us. So if increased school funding was going to happen, it is going to happen now.
So why isn't it happening?
Well, that's what we're trying to get started, right? So we're starting with the Student Success Act, which is a proposition to increase corporate gains taxes because we have the lowest here, that folks, the lowest corporate tax rate in the nation of all 50 states. We have the lowest. And yet we have the second highest dropout rate in the country. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to say, hey, let's balance that out a little bit, raise corporate tax rate for corporate gains, and it's proposing basically a gain of $2 billion that actually is earmarked for things such as early childhood education and increased counselors, mental health supports, and nurses. That's where we're seeing that money being hopefully earmarked to go to. But the thing is, folks, that $2 billion doesn't cover it, because what federal studies say is that a state of our size, with the amount of students that we have, we need a roughly $10 billion.
Yeah.
$10 billion. The previous budget was $8.1 billion. That does not cut it, folks. And that may not seem like a huge difference between $8.1 and $10 billion, but that is a huge number. Yes. It is a chasm. So we're trying to close that gap. The Student Success Act has not yet been voted on in the Senate, and the actual general budget has not yet been passed, and a concrete number has not necessarily been proposed yet. So it's interesting how the Student Success Act is being sort of pushed forward, this $2 billion, before we really even vote on what exactly the budget is going to be for Ed. But that's what our state union, the Oregon Education Association, has pushed for, and that's what our local unions are supporting. And what I think is the most important part here right now for everybody to know out there is that because we have a supermajority, the Republicans, who 12 of them who were on this committee, all voted against this, this increase in funding and this increase in corporate tax rate.
They left notes on their desk?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you want
to? No, all I know is that today, the third day in a row, they haven't showed up in session to vote. So, and they need two. They only need two to show up to vote.
And they are being paid. And they are not showing up to work. What would happen if working class folks did not show up to work for 3 days? Uh-huh. Would they be getting paid? No. Would they be getting fired? Hell yes.
Right. Right.
And that is not what's happening. Mm-hmm. In fact, the state sheriffs can actually go and get them and bring them to their posts. And they know that. So not only have they left their offices, but they have left the state. They have left the state. They are hiding in a different state in order to avoid voting, to create a quorum. Mm-hmm. If there's two of them there, that means that there's a quorum and it goes to a vote. Mm-hmm. So all of them are gone in order to delay. I mean, once they come back, there's no way to necessarily avoid this. We have the supermajority. Yeah. Why they're doing this, I think it's a statement. I think it's the only card that they have left to play. Mm-hmm. But what we really know is that is the most important thing here, which is that our classrooms are bursting at the seams. They are bursting at the seams. We have huge, huge, huge class sizes. And for every additional student that we put in that class, that's another minute that teacher cannot get to every student.
Yeah, I saw, I think one of my favorite signs of the day was a young woman who had a sign that said, "I love my friends, but 40 classmates is too much."
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think somebody in Beaverton said 30 is a speed limit. It is not a class size.
Yes, that was right. Another sign I saw. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Sean, do you want to talk about your caseload?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
So let's use Michigan as an example. I have a colleague who worked in Michigan as a special education teacher, and at one point they had 18 students on their special education caseload. And that was considered very high. Colleagues of theirs exclaimed, "My goodness, what a high caseload you have. You must have a lot of work to do." Well, my caseload at one point this year was 34. So that's 34 students. And that is, it may not sound like a lot, but it is quite a lot. Justin, do you want to kind of explain a little bit about
yes. the logistics? Yes. So since I worked where Sean works now, I know how it goes. So you have eight periods in a day. You have five classes. Luckily, our school that we worked at, you get an extra period as a special education teacher because you have a mile high pile of paperwork to complete. Mm-hmm. So not only do you have 34 kids on IEPs, what that means is that they all have an IEP, which is an individual education plan that takes a team together to write, including the student, their family, an administrator, a gen ed teacher, special education teacher, sometimes a speech pathologist, an occupational therapist, an adaptive PE teacher. There is a whole host of people who can be there. So not only do you have that paperwork and those kids, you might not see those kids throughout the day. They might be with other teachers. You're also teaching your own classes and co-teaching in a gen ed class. Mm. So you have five classes that you have to plan for and teach, grade papers for. Kids are coming in on your break needing things, needing support. There might be a fight. There might be a meeting with a parent. There might be 18 phone calls to make. Mm. And then you still have the paperwork at the end of the day. Mm-hmm.
And all the meetings.
And all the meetings.
And the meetings. And yeah. the meetings. And I will not complain. It is an honor and a privilege yes. to serve those students with disabilities that I serve. And I feel blessed and grateful every day. That day is a 12-hour day. Yeah. And
you're getting paid for eight of them, mm-hmm. 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm. A little bit of overtime pay sometimes, but usually not. And again, I am not complaining. It is what the job requires, and that is because we are understaffed. And because of chronic underfunding, that's mm-hmm. caused chronic understaffing. And because of that chronic understaffing, we see high levels of distress and stress among our student populations and among our teacher populations. And teachers are leaving the special ed profession in droves. In fact, Lewis and Clark had to reduce its teaching teacher program by a huge amount several years ago, and then it had to eliminate its special education endorsement program for a period of time because of the low enrollment. The word is out. This job is hard. It is very low paying, and it takes everything out of you. And I personally will say that I have had to sacrifice a good many things, including my mental health. When I first got into this profession, I worked at an elementary school with a very high caseload, and I was working 14-hour days, and my mental health deteriorated. I wasn't eating, I wasn't sleeping, I was having frequent panic attacks because I got into this profession to help students, to work with students and to listen to them deeply and help provide them the services that they need to have access to the general education classroom and to have access to being able to feel successful every day that they walk into where they spend the majority of their time living, which is our public schools. And when I realized that I didn't actually have enough minutes in the day to actually accomplish that job, I just said, well, screw it. I'm just going to extend my day. And I ended up in extreme mental health distress. And I had to leave and take a little break for a while. And when I was in a support group for people who were experiencing extreme levels of stress, it is not an accident that there was a social worker and another special ed teacher in a very small group of people. Mm-hmm. You know, that is not an accident that we see social service workers, special ed teachers ending up in mental health distress because we care so much, but we are not given the tools to actually achieve our goal, which is to help, which is to serve our students.
And that's how we got into the situation where you are launching the walkout activity.
Absolutely.
Because, of course, someone who doesn't want the boat to be rocked, that just wants everything to be nice and calm, would say to all of the educators, well, why don't you just write a letter? Or why don't you just, you know, do a call-in campaign? Why would you stop instruction? What do we say to them?
Absolutely. We say we are building on the teacher walkouts and strikes from around the nation, from West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona, Los Angeles, Denver, and Oakland. It is time, it is past time to fund the schools our students deserve. Our students can't wait one more day, and neither can we. Neither can we. Neither can our communities.
Thank you, Sean.
So I'm hoping that people who may have seen the walkout and, you know, just generally, we should be able to talk about this honestly on The Struggle, and we do, as most of the people who come onto my show are people who engage in direct action and use that approach in order to get what they need in their communities to thrive. And one of the most common themes is that people feel like that's just, it's going too far, it's too confrontational, it's too in your face. Like, how do we convince people that this is dire enough, that this action is warranted? Like,
well, I think part of it is when you make a disruption and you're not in school that day, people pay attention. I mean, if there are 20,000 people down at the Tahmacaw Waterfront Park, they weren't all teachers. There were bus drivers, there were paraeducators, there were parents, there were teachers, there were friends of teachers.
And students.
I mean, there was everybody who's affected by schools there. And so people pay attention to that.
The best people who were there were all kids.
All the kids, absolutely.
OEA, the Oregon Education Association, asked me to be a chant leader.
Cool.
Frankly,
smart of them. I've heard you belt. I've heard you shout, and I'm louder than any megaphone. I don't even need it.
Generally furious, but I wanted the kids to feel what it's like to lead and chant, and did call and response with all of them on the bullhorn, so that they can get the experience of having dozens of people around you respond to your call and know that you have that power. You can do that. That's how you extend your voice. So to me, that is as important, if not more important than any other part of the whole action, is that children are learning how to fight for their own futures.
Yes.
Absolutely.
How incredible.
And we see that, you know, we see that in the student walkouts that have been staged to fight against gun violence. And we see that in the student walkouts for climate justice. Vitka Kemper was a 19-year-old Holocaust. She was a Jew in the Holocaust. And she left her village and left her ghetto and smuggled young people like herself out and into the forest to commit espionage against the Nazi regime. They blew up electricity transformers to stop water flow to the Nazis. They blew up a train line in order to stop the flow to and from the Nazis and to and from the ghetto of people to be gassed.
It's a little
she
disruptive.
Blew up, yes, oh, it's just a little bit. Oh, and she and they poisoned Nazis as well. And you know what Jews said when they watched her group of young people? They said, "You are too loud. This is too much. You're making things worse. The Nazis are retaliating against us." And you know what Vitka said? They, in response to when there was a big hubbub after that electricity transformer was taken down by her group, she said they didn't know that a few Jewish boys and girls did that. Now, she used the words boys and girls. She did not say men and women, because that's who was doing this, the young people. And even those who of that oppressed group who were older were saying, quiet down, it's too much, it's too loud, it's too reactionary. And you know what? Vitka and her group of young people saved lives, and that's what's at stake right now. And our young people know it just as much today as they did in 1942.
Absolutely. I want to give a shout out once again. I've given multiple shout outs to my friends who are in the No SROs PDX School Resource Officers, Portland Public Schools, or any public school, contracting with the police to have armed officers in the police to monitor, surveil, and they say serve and protect students. So, I mean, you can take them at their word if you want to. But there's a movement of students who are fighting back against that are not only pointing out the fact that there are rats in their schools, there's no clean water, there's not enough books, not enough teachers, the lights are off, the paint is peeling, and the school is saying we're going to spend a multi-million dollar contract on police to surveil you. So students are fighting back. So I just want to say hi to my friends Sarah and Sophia, who came on The Struggle a few months ago. If y'all want to come back on and give everybody an update, you're more than welcome. But like that's who was in my mind when you were talking about those heroic kids fighting back against the Nazis. These kids are fighting against the militarism of the U.S. in 2019. It's not that far of a cry, honestly.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we've had this huge demonstration, right? What is happening now? Like, what is that? It's Friday. It's 2 days later. So what's happening now? Is there an update?
Well, the Republicans are hiding, as we've said before. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And students are really fired up. Teachers are really fired up. We're waiting a little bit on hearing from our state union. You know, there's still rah-rah, sis, boom-bah, Student Success Act, $2 billion, still, you know, at least $7 billion short of what we really need to move forward. And I am interested to see how it moves forward, because what has happened before, Alyssa and everybody listening, is that what they do, what our state Congress does, is they wait and they wait and they wait till the very last second of the budgetary session. And then when they pass a school budget, they're like, we did it, plant the flag, you know, shoot the confetti cannons. We managed to do it. It was so hard, but we did it. And every time they do it, it's underfunded. And we're facing huge cuts in Beaverton. We're facing cuts in Portland Public of teachers, 300 teachers, Beaverton, I believe, 45 teachers in Portland, all kinds of cuts. I mean, they're already, it's cuts. These are the shortages. It's death by 1,000 cuts.
Okay.
If we do not get this money, this is what will happen. And these cuts are already like in rolling, like it's already, we're already getting notices and preps that like there's going to be cuts. Beaverton teachers are already on high alert and they're in high distress right now. Does that speak to what you were saying?
Yeah. Well, I want people to know sort of like what is proactively happening. Like, where does the campaign go from here?
Oh, absolutely. So I think one of the things that you can do is that you can definitely call Senator Thompson and urge him to get back to work. He is your Republican senator, ladies and gentlemen, and everybody in between. And right now he is hiding from doing his job and getting paid for it. His number, get a pen, please, is 503-986-1726. I'll say that number again, folks. It's 503-986-1726. Please urge him to get back to the state, sit in that seat, and do his job, just like teachers are doing right now,
His name once more
is Senator Thompson.
And the reason we're calling him is because?
Because he and his other Republican colleagues are hiding. They are hiding so that we cannot vote on an increased school funding bill to get our students the services that they desperately, desperately need.
So this is part of a larger trend. So you mentioned some of the other successful educator strikes across the country, but the idea of public education and fully funded quality public education is up for debate again, suddenly. I want to talk about like how this trend came to be. And how are we to relate to it and resist it?
I think certainly it started with the No Child Left Behind Act that your good friend George W. Bush put in place. That was a test-based initiative measure designed to put gobs and gobs of money in the pockets of test makers such as Pearson, the Pearson family, close personal friend of the Bush family for a long, long time. Sorry, I don't mean to sound too conspiracy theory,
well,
folks.
They make
but
the
it's,
test. Their names are there. They're known friends.
It's not a secret.
It's the only place where you can take tests for endorsements. It's the only place.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a little bit sidetracky, let's go there. Teachers now, in order to be certified and licensed to become teachers, have to submit a video to Pearson of a lesson that they're teaching. Now, when you submit that lesson, you are giving up the rights to that lesson. And Pearson is a curriculum creation and test creation company.
Wow.
So what they are doing is they are taking intellectual property from our brightest educators, the people who are the most enthusiastic, those who are trying to get certified to become teachers. They are showing the best of the best, and all of that intellectual property becomes Pearson's, and that's not an accident. And it unfortunately continued in the Obama administration when Obama chose a pro-charter minister of education.
What is a charter?
A charter school is a school that is funded with public education dollars, where students leave their neighborhood schools and the money leaves with them when they go to a charter school. Now, I will say that I hold this cognitive dissonance in my mind, being a special education teacher, that number one, I am a huge supporter of public education and public schools. And on the other hand, I also know that public school settings do not work for every student. So I understand the impetus behind the creation for charter schools, but I also understand that the actual functionality and the way that it's been put into place is that there's wealthy people with their hands out getting gobs and gobs of money in other states. And what it looks like in this state is there's no better outcomes for students academically. And we see that those students take those dollars with them and take them away from their neighborhood schools. And many of those charters are coming up and then shutting down.
They're for-profit schools.
Well, no. Some charters are for profit and some are not. But the ones that are not are funded with public education dollars that are now not going to those public schools, where those neighborhood schools where those students would be otherwise.
I really want people to understand the difference, because some people may not be clear on what the difference between sending their kid to a charter school versus a public school is. So I just wanted to lay that out a little bit more.
Absolutely.
More bare.
And those teachers are being paid less. It's important to know that they're not in the union, unless they're in their own, union. But they're not in the Greater Portland Public School, Portland Association of Teachers Union. And teachers are leaving those schools in droves. There's a huge high turnover rate on that part of those teachers. Not all charters are bad, but I'm just putting out some of those things that are problematic about charters. Can I speak, and maybe me and Justin can speak a little bit about the school-to-prison pipeline?
Please.
Yeah, I think as special educators, we're in a unique position to speak to that.
So first, please just say what the school-to-prison pipeline is. They're fighting over the
mic. I do.
So I'll just say, Sean did his homework. He's such a great teacher. He texted me this morning and said, come with me. So I'm deferring all the facts to Sean.
It sounds good. It sounds totally legit. And please jump in, because your voice is so
valuable. I will jump in
when
I'm,
awesome.
Thank you.
Consent. It's beautiful. School to prison pipeline. With the U.S. Census reports that 20% of Americans have a disability. The Bureau of Justice found that 32% of federal prisoners and 40% of jailed inmates live with disability. Many of the stories of these inmates can be traced back to being alienated from the first system that they were a member of, which is their school. Without proper staffing and support, students with disabilities and learning differences become more and more alienated from the very system that is supposed to be this great equalizer, this free public education. And if you can't have access to what is going on in the classroom every day, and there are not enough adults there to support you in having access to that curriculum, it becomes easier emotionally to just say, screw this system. There's only so many times you can hit your head against a brick wall before you have to walk away. And with that understaffing and crammed caseloads, like we see here in Oregon right now, our most vulnerable students slip through the cracks. And I believe that this is why students with disabilities make up a disproportionately large section of our inmate population in the United States.
I'll add on to that. When I worked at the school where Sean is now, I had a caseload of about 24 students, and I would say 19 of them were young men of color, brown and black men. And a lot of them had the educational disability of emotional disturbance, which means that you are not able to function in the world under normal circumstances, and you react in oppositional ways, put it that way. So if you're thinking about So if you're thinking about black and brown men and how they're treated in this country right now, and those are the kids I was working with, the highest behavior population, and 19 out of 25 were young men of color. And those were the kids who were getting in fights. Those are the kids I was going into meetings for in the principal's office. Those were the parents I was having to call. Those are the kids I was having to write behavior plans for. And as a white guy working with families of color, I know that I have to build trust within those kids and those families before they'll listen to me. So I had to keep showing up and showing up for them, which I was happy to do. And I kept seeing the same kids falling into the same patterns, and certain teachers and administrators treating them in certain ways. And I think that's kind of what Sean was just talking about.
Which is what brings upon the emotional disturbance in the first
absolutely.
Place.
Absolutely. Yeah. How can you function in this world if everyone you see like you is treated in a poor way?
Yeah.
You see your brothers and your sisters and whoever being arrested, taken away, being hurt, being killed on the street. I would have a hard time functioning emotionally well myself. So.
Absolutely. Institutionalized racism and systemic poverty has deep multi-generational effects that are felt for hundreds and hundreds of years. And we see that coming out in our schools. And I don't know if any of y'all are up on the news, but we're seeing increasing reports of violence. Students who are, you know, from very, very young to up all the way to high school, the levels of violence in classrooms is increasing and increasing and increasing. And a lot of people are kind of wondering, what's that about? What's going on? And I want to say that the students that we've got right now, at least in our high school and younger, are all post-2008 crash kiddos. They grew up in extremely under-resourced homes in a situation where there was not enough resources at home and not a lot of money being funneled to home. And we're seeing the consequences and the symptoms of poverty, of extreme poverty, being embodied within our students, not being able to emotionally regulate and lashing out because of the stresses that poverty and systemic racism and institutionalized systems of impoverishment are having on those families and those students and those children. So it's very complex. Yeah. It's very complex. Things are getting worse. We need more teachers. We need more counselors.
And I want to speak to that too, if I can, for a moment. The school, so I actually got burnt out at a public high school. My physical health was being affected. I was not sleeping. And I got an opportunity to interview for this alternative school, which the classrooms are small. We have 12 kids in the class, able to establish relationships with all the students. And most of them have come to the place where they are now because they've been a threat to themselves or others, a lot of suicidal ideation, things like that. And a lot of what the kids tell me is that they don't have the support that they need at school. If they're struggling emotionally, they're told to buck up, they're told it's not real, they're told that everyone gets sad and depressed, and this is from teachers. I really am an advocate now for having that more mental health in schools, especially for teenagers, middle school, high school for sure, that there's more and not less, and now they're talking about taking away more of these
resources. Is that widely understood as the best answer? Like, what are other educators saying about, like,
where I work, all the educators where I work, there's six of us, we all agree. I think it's in I don't know how it is where you work, Sean, but I would imagine that especially special education teachers and teachers who, you know, teachers are like regular people. Some people are very passionate about their job and their students. Other people, it's just a job. So you find with your colleagues who are your supports and who are there for the students. And I'd say there's more of them than not.
Absolutely. I think it's a general consensus. And certainly the consensus of our local union that we need more mental health supports, more counselors, more nurses. We've got multiple schools sharing one nurse, and we've got a huge population. I work at, I don't want to give away where I work, but it's a very large high school. We have a full inclusion special education program. And what that means on the ground is that instead of getting sort of sheltered content classes that are mostly for students who have learning differences and learning struggles, those students are in the general education classroom, which means that they need a lot of accommodation and support in order to be able to have full access to that curriculum. They're not the student that can come in and write a 5-paragraph essay, right? They may be, but they may not be. And we've got 200-ish of those students, and we've got seven staff, special ed staff. They can't be, I mean, each one of those students has 8 classes each. And none of those classes are sheltered curriculum that is designed to be at their level or to support them at their level. So it's on the general education teachers, but really it's also really on the special education staff to try to help make that happen. We have two, for 200 students, do you want to speak to this,
please? So let me back up a little bit. If you're in special education, you're in elementary school, you might be in a classroom with 10 kids and you might have a teacher and four paraeducators, which are like teacher assistants. And you might have this through eighth grade through middle school.
Shout out to all the paraeducators.
Yeah, I was one for 10 years.
I was one for two years. Yes. I totally get it.
So we have that struggle as well. We worked on the front lines. So in high school, when you get to high school, you have two paraeducators to support 200 kids with IEPs. So you think the kids are that have the highest needs, they get the most support, and the kids who really need support but are kind of fly under the radar, the kids who are quiet in class, they're failing their classes but they're not a behavior problem, so they don't get the support that they need. And they're looking about taking away support of paraeducators as well, instead of adding more. They need to do their math different. You need to multiply and not subtract here.
So I think it's worth saying, what is the reasoning for all of this on the other side? What are they saying? How do they justify this? The people who are against full funding, what's their excuse?
I think that they see teachers as babysitters. Mm-hmm. And I think that they also see teachers as people who are freeloaders because we get, quote unquote, 2 months off. What's your take?
I've also heard too, why should I pay for more taxes? Right. You guys get enough already. Mm-hmm. I've heard that argument.
Well, yeah, the fact that we get a retirement is a really big issue for a lot of people. The fact that we're able to retire by the age of 65 or however, 30 years
but
of teaching.
I believe PERS, teachers is 40% of PERS. Also firefighters and police officers also mm-hmm. get PERS. So it's not just teachers. People think it's just teachers.
Public education retirement services.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I asked that. Of course, I'm a very open supporter of educators and of teachers' unions. So I say that question to be contrarian and to pull it out. What is the other side saying? Just so that we can destroy their arguments. It's really worth saying that they have been working so hard to malign teachers like for decades, and it's not working, because when you get right down to it, it is teachers that are taking care of all of our kids.
Yeah.
And they are able to tap in to, y'all are certainly able to tap into the psyche of children and understand them and be able to relate to them and educate them, comfort them, help them to be better humans as they grow up. And there's really no way to get around that. These will continue to be important people in our communities no matter what you do.
Absolutely. And I think that they're being very strategic to try to focus on the retirement, because what we're fighting for, unlike some of our union members in other states, what we're fighting for right now is not teacher pay raises.
No.
We are fighting for more staffing and more resources for our students. So the only real thing that the opposition can kind of cling to is the fact that we get a retirement. There's a problem with how our retirement's being funded. But let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater. Let's focus on what we're asking for, which is more services for the students that they desperately need. And as a professional, and I'd love to, if you feel comfortable speaking to this, Justin, as a professional special education teacher, I seek to be a listener and not a gatekeeper for those who live with disabilities.
Great.
I am not a service giver. My mission and on my best days is to elevate the voices of young people who live with disability, not to be constantly trying to solutionify everything, but to sit in the grief of the realities of my students and their lives, and to advocate for them to other professionals, my fellow teachers, and to see the incredible, to help those other wonderful educators see the incredible strengths that these young people are bringing to the table with them every day.
Yes, I just want to kind of back up what Sean said. I learn more from my students than I have probably in college. I learn from listening. I remember I have two ears and one mouth, so I try to listen as twice as much as I talk. And a lot of my work these days is not only am I a teacher, I'm a mentor, I'm a counselor. I listen to the students, what they have to say. They have so much to say. I get a lot of feedback from kids. They really pay attention. They know what's going on. And so a lot of the passion that I come for advocating for these kids is from their stories and what they tell me. And they have BS radars. They know for sure when people are not telling them the truth. And if people listen to kids more, I think we would be having different conversations. But adults always think that they're right and that their voices are the ones we should be listening to.
Okay. So we had a very strong show of force. It was only one day, right? So we've been able to show that we can turn out tens of thousands of people onto the streets. It wasn't just Portland, but other cities and towns in Oregon turned out big numbers as well. So everyone now knows that we can turn out a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So that's one element of what's needed for a successful movement or campaign. So what are people saying needs to be done next in order to be victorious?
I really wish that a rep from our state or local union was here, because they have a lot more ear on the ground. You know what I did today? I did lesson plans, grade papers, and did special education paperwork and taught two classes. What I did not do was look at anything other than the news bulletin. So I'm unfamiliar with what's not being shared with us right now, at least from Portland Association of Teachers and Oregon Education Association, what our next step is if this full funding budget isn't passed. Like, sure, this Student Success Act bill will most likely pass. We have the votes, but there's been no finalized education budget brought to the floor. So, you know, what if it's under what we know to be what we need, which is at least $9 billion? There has been no answer to the what if. And what I hope is that our local unions will be leaders and push for another walkout, because we cannot wait for our contracts to come up and negotiate with our superintendent.
Right.
Because our school districts only get so much money from the state. We're taking it to the state. We're taking the fight to the state. And that's what we're doing right now. We've never done this before. This has never been done before. Mm. So we're kind of flying by the seat of our pants here a little bit, or at least I feel like the teachers who are working on the ground feel like that a little bit.
Wow.
So I'm eager to hear what our plan, our what if plan is.
Okay, Justin, have you heard anything about what will happen next?
I don't, but my good friend, he is my union rep in my school building, and he is also a social studies teacher. So he's the one I'll get the lowdown from, and I will keep you posted.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think people really want to know, especially when you can turn out such big numbers. It's a show of your power. So
now 25 school districts closed, 600 schools on Wednesday. That is a mastodon.
Yeah. So it's a big show, right? So everyone knows
it's never been done.
Now everyone knows you've got the power to do it.
Power, yeah.
And now it's a question: what will you do with that power? It's a big question. So let's say you're consultants, right? So let's say you're going to be able to lead the struggle how you see fit. So let's do some imagination. What will happen if you had your way?
Well, we've already had lots of lobby days, a couple lobby days where teachers go into Salem and they're letting our Congress
speak on the floor.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Teachers speak on the floor. So they've heard our voices. That has already happened. They're on the actual day of protest on Wednesday, that walkout, some people went to Salem and there were no Republicans to be found. Sorry, don't mean to beat that.
No, it's okay. No, talk about it.
No, it's very important.
Yeah.
Three days in a row.
Yeah. In fact, will you reiterate for people that may not have been listening earlier, like when you say that there were no Republicans to be found, can you just say you're getting at?
In order to prevent the supermajority Democratic vote to pull through the Student Success Act funding, increased school funding bill, all of the Republican senators left the state. And they are continuing to be gone in order to prevent from being a quorum, because there has to be two members of the other party for there to be a quorum in order to have a vote. So that is very strategic on their part. And because the reason they left the state and not just left their offices is because sheriffs can technically come, find them, and escort them to do their jobs. And so if they're out of state, the sheriffs can't come get them. So that's happening.
So I want to go back to your question, Lisa. I believe that, you know, there's been a lot of teachers lobbying and we've heard teachers' voices, but I believe the impact will come from the students themselves. If we had more students speaking from their experiences, what they see in the classrooms, that's where the voices are. I mean, we can talk all we want about our struggles and how hard it is and we're there for the kids. But when the kids start talking and people start listening, I think that's when the change will happen. I mean, like what Sean was saying at the beginning of the hour about all the youth activists, that is where the future is.
So what are the kids saying that you're talking to?
Well, the kids that I'm talking to currently are telling me that in their regular ed schools, in their big high schools and middle schools, that teachers and students aren't taking them seriously when they talk about depression, and when they talk about suicide, when they talk about anxiety, that they're told that, well, all teenagers are sad, you're just get over it, that kind of stuff. And they end up where I work now because people aren't taking them seriously. There isn't any one person that they can go talk to because the one counselor has 700 kids to talk to.
Okay. Yeah. So the kids are saying, believe us.
Believe us. Listen to us. And they're also saying there are too many kids in my classroom. I feel like I'm lost. There's 35 people in here and there's one teacher.
Yeah, pay teachers whatever you want. But if you throw... even if you paid me like a doctor, if I've got 35 kids in my classroom, there's no way I'm getting to every single one of those kids and giving them the help and individuated education that they need and deserve.
And then if you have, you're teaching six classes times 35, you do the math, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Lower class sizes.
Yeah, lower class sizes for sure.
And more teachers equals lower class sizes.
Yeah.
What are some of your students saying?
My students are essentially, so behavior is communication. And what I'm seeing a lot of is students skipping class, you know, in those classes that are overloaded with teachers. They're saying, well, my teacher is not helping me and I need to go. And I don't, it's too loud in there for me. I work with a lot of students who have sensory processing issues. I work with students with special education needs. I see students breaking down, giving up on their work, on their homework. They're feeling overloaded. They're not feeling supported at school. A lot of them are working jobs and supporting their families. A lot of them are helping raise their younger siblings, and school is the last thing on their mind, and they don't have enough support at school to be able to do both.
Another thing I'm hearing is kids are saying there's too much testing and not enough hands-on learning. Mm-hmm. I feel like the classes I'm made to take have nothing to do with my future.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We need more media production mm-hmm. classes. We need automotive classes. Benson High School is fabulous. It's a trade school. So many students want to go there. And we need more of those trade school type classes in every school. We've got a good metal shop. We've got a good wood shop in our school, but there's no pre-nursing. There's no music production. There's a little bit of video production, but we need more. Students need more feeling of relevance. You know, we're educating every student as if they're going to go to a four-year university, which students know the jig is up, right? Yeah. It's not, you can't afford it.
That's right.
The jig is up. So they're like, well, what? They're interested in the trades more than ever now. Yeah.
So it's really important. So I thank you for talking about what your students are saying to you, because I think that's at the heart of this. So now thinking about pivoting to the listening audience and some closing thoughts about what is it that you want the takeaway to be to people who are listening. Because, of course, we've been talking about some really dire, dark mm-hmm. stuff. And that can leave people feeling hopeless and like frozen and incapable of moving forward. So is there any hope here? And if so, what? And how should people plug in that are listening?
I'll just say it again. Listen to kids. Listen to students. That is, to me, I have become a better person because of my students. It's made me want to be better in this world, to show up for the students who are struggling the most. And with the cuts that the schools are talking about, the kids who need the most support are the ones that are going to be the most affected. Mm-hmm. So listen to those kids. Give them a microphone.
Yep, give the kids a mic. Give the kids a megaphone like you've done, mm-hmm. Alyssa.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
If there are any parents who are listening and your kids feel bold enough to step to the mic, I will interview you and your kids, your public school students, absolutely. I'm landing on here I'm thinking, in whose interest is this? Right, this is a national tendency. This isn't just an Oregon crisis. It's an especially Oregon crisis because of our low tax rate. But the reason that there's a low tax rate,
corporate tax rate,
right. Thank you. Yes. Right. People are paying enough. Mm-hmm. Okay, mm-hmm. Is because of a marriage to big business. Mm-hmm. Right, having multinationals write your tax bills for you,
absolutely,
and wondering why ordinary people are getting the shaft. Yeah. Well, this is why, and as long as we mm-hmm. allow for this supremacy to stay in place, mm-hmm. this is going to be the drain that we continue to circle, and it's dark and it's sad, but I mean.
Yeah, please don't vote for Nike executives to be on your school boards.
That would be great.
That's a great start.
That would be great. Let's end on that nice shady note.
all students are future adults.
Yes.
So all teachers are educating future adults, whichever professions that they choose to go into. So just remember that. That's why we should really listen to the students, to the children.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Sean, Justin, thank you.
Thank you.
Again, this is Alyssa Pariah, your friendly neighborhood agitator. This is The Struggle on KBOO FM 90.7 and also online at kboo.fm. Please listen every Friday at 7, and our archives go up almost immediately after the show's finish. So please check out all of the episodes that you may have missed. We'll see you all next week. Thank you and good luck.
Join us on Sunday, June 2nd from 2 to 4 p.m. for KBOO's 51st birthday party and birthday cake potluck. Bring a birthday cake if you can and celebrate the existence of 51 wonderful years of grassroots, volunteer-run, independent community radio serving Portland, Cascadia, and the world. KBOO is an independent, member-supported, non-commercial, volunteer-powered community radio station. KBOO embodies equitable social change, shared knowledge, and fosters creativity by delivering locally rooted and diverse music, culture, news, and opinions with a commitment to the voices of oppressed and underserved communities. Again, that's KBOO's 51st birthday party and birthday cake potluck on Sunday, June 2nd from 2 to 4 p.m. at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/51birthday party.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Tomorrow Will Be, Friday, May 10th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. Tomorrow Will Be is an